Welcome to the Find Creative Expression Podcast, conversations about art and creativity. I'm your host, Sarah Crawford, author, musician, and playwright. You can find the show notes and other information at findcreativeexpression.com. And let's get going. Hey, everyone, and welcome to episode 19 of the Find Creative Expression Podcast. Coming up a little later, I have an interview with writer Sarah Fox. I had a great time chatting with Sarah, so stick around for that. So my poetry book release was last week of my new book of poems called Slip Away. I also re-released Coiled and Swallowed from 2010 and Driving Downtown to the Show from 2012. And I live streamed a little reading of some of these poems, which was super fun. And that's still up on my Facebook page if anyone wants to check it out. I can also link to that on findcreativeexpression.com. So yesterday, my cat Julian woke me up at like 5 a.m. wanting food. And, you know, as I was trying to go back to sleep after I fed her, I got this random idea for a play. So I scribbled down a few notes in my phone and I thought, you know, that would be good enough and I could just go back to sleep. But then I just kept thinking about it and I couldn't sleep. So I just got up and started writing. And I wrote like 10 pages, so that was awesome. And you know, I must have a sense that the end of the pandemic is at least on the horizon if I'm writing plays again. But you know, I was thinking about this the other day, and you know, I got into this a little bit with Sarah too. This whole past year with the pandemic and being in quarantine, yes, obviously it's been tragic, and you know, we all wish it didn't have to happen, but it also gave us some opportunities too. As Sarah mentioned, it's really made things more accessible for people who maybe couldn't get out as much before due to disability or even social anxiety. And I know for a lot of us, it kind of forced us to be creative in ways that we aren't normally. I remember when the pandemic first hit, and I became obsessed with making banana bread. And I'm not usually a person who cooks or bakes or really does any of that. I try sometimes, but, you know. It also helped me to start writing songs again and playing music. And I think it taught us a lot about how many jobs actually can be done from home and how many of those meetings actually could have been emails. It also just kind of slowed down the pace for many of us. So, you know, the pandemic is not over by any stretch of the imagination. And I definitely don't think you should be going out to raves or anything. But it does feel like something has shifted. More and more people are getting the vaccine, and it does feel like we can, if not see the light at the end of the tunnel, at least know it's there. So I hope we don't just go back to normal and not take anything we've learned during this time to improve our lives and improve the world. Anyway, let's go ahead and get right into the interview. I'm here with Sarah Fox. Sarah Fox is a writer whose stories generally dabble around fantasy coming of age and emotive sci-fi with LGBT plus characters. And they have a burn for Southern folklore, mythology, and surrealist description. In addition to writing, they have been a researcher, a teacher, and a techie. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us on the Find Creative Expression Podcast, episode 19. I'm like shocked that there have been 19 episodes.
I think it's wonderful. I've been listening to like a couple of them every so often, and I've really enjoyed the ways you've been introducing different creative people and all the things that they do. So it's been a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to talking with you today.
Cool. Yeah, awesome. I you know, I love talking creativity with people. So how did you get into writing?
You know, it's kind of like one of those like same old story. You like get the same answer like 60 times because like most writers, it's sort of like, oh yes, once upon a time when I was a wee child. And it's pretty much the same thing. I was in first grade. I had a really great babysitter one day and we wrote like obviously very short stories with illustrations. Mm-hmm. And I used that for, I think it was like show and tell that week or something. I don't remember. But what I do remember is that everyone laughed. I wrote a short story. It was called The Greatest Show and Tell Ever. It involved a pants falling down joke, all that stuff. And people actually understood it and laughed. And for me, realizing that I could use writing as a way of communicating thoughts and feelings was just revolutionary.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. Like people started laughing. You're like, oh, all right.
This is a way that people actually understand what I'm saying. Fabulous. Let's do this more. And then I annoyed that class a lot.
Yeah. You know, I was always such a like shy, awkward kid. Well, I'm kind of still awkward anyway.
I think we're all awkward. So if that helps.
Yeah. So, you know, I feel like a lot of people get into writing because they can express themselves a lot better in writing than in speaking. I mean, I know that's how it is for me.
Oh, yeah. If you're like, hey, do you want to speak this or do you want to write an essay? I'm like, oh, my goodness, essay, which doesn't work very well for a podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I have to write everything down before I say it on the podcast. Well, I mean, not everything, but, you know, the questions. I write this down beforehand. Yeah.
Some guidelines.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I just brilliantly think of all this off the cuff. Yes.
I mean, like, I would believe it.
So in your writing process, do you plot out your stories or fly by the seat of your pants?
So it's kind of funny because in a lot of ways, like I would have, like before I really took a long time to like look over the different ways and the methodologies and all that stuff that, you know, that we've been learning with Carrie, you know, at different times, I would have said, oh, I'm definitely, I fly by the seat of my pants. But the reality is I actually plot a lot more than I realize. So for like a short story, a lot of times I will have a beginning. Like my brain is just like, this is where it starts. And I'm like, oh cool, cool, mm-hmm. cool. We got a beginning. And then it'll be like, and this is where it ends. And you're like, okay, good, good. And maybe there's some like description or theme, or maybe a little bit of dialogue, some sort of random thing that's like part of the middle. And I'm like, great, got my guardrails. Let's see where this goes. I still know where it ends and I still know where it begins, but some of that middle kind of is a little bit more nebulous. So it's plotting, but you also, you know, have a little bit of that leeway. I'm never going to be like this scene, this scene, this scene, this scene, this scene, because that's not enough flexibility for me.
Right, right. Yeah. Every time I try to be a plotter, I, you know, I'll write these elaborate outlines and then I'll start writing. And I'll just do something totally different.
Elaborate outlines make me bored. So I really just need the guardrails. I need to know, you know, if it's a longer story, I need to know what part of it and why am I writing this part? What's the point? Kind of.
Yeah. And I mean, I think for us pantsers, well, I mean, you said we're not entirely a pantser, but plantsers, if you will. You know, I feel like part of the exciting thing for me about writing is kind of discovering the story. And I feel like that happens in the process for me, you know?
Yeah. See, I typically go into it knowing at least the theme or the emotion, something that I'm trying to get at. And then from there, I just sort of build out those guardrails. Now those guardrails will change. Sometimes I'm like, oh, that's not going to work. And I rip out the guardrail and I do something different. But typically when I say, hey, this is the beginning and this is the end, those parts stay. They're like right. The really deep stopping points, but everything else just, you know, it's there, it moves. I add an extra chapter. I add an extra scene. The rest of it is a lot more nebulous.
Mm-hmm. So do you always start with a theme or like an emotion? Do you ever start with like characters or an image?
I would say that all of my stories typically begin with some sort of emotion. So there's something I want to explore. So, for example, when the letter comes, it's that feeling of, like, so the innate beginning of that was, what happens when you don't get what you always wanted? And what's worse, what happens when your sister gets it? I mean, just that's awful. Or like, I have a short story coming out with Writers of the Future, Volume 37. And really, that's kind of like a reverse introspection on my dad's death. So it's all about like that grieving process, but it's kind of like looking back and like digging through it. And of course, making it more sci-fi than my reality is. I would like it to be otherwise, but you know, we're here on Earth.
Unless you're writing dystopian, and then it's pretty similar.
Yeah, true, true. I like to, I like, I'm kind of at the point where I'm like, please, can we like edge off of the dystopian in our lives? That would be really nice. Thanks.
Exactly. So when you're writing, what are you inspired by? Like, do you write to music or anything like that?
I always have a playlist of some sort, and it's like thematically or emotively based on the different characters or what I'm writing. And a lot of times, what I'll end up doing is I'll listen to that before I start writing. So I typically go for a long walk, be it in my house or outside, depending on what the weather is. And I listen to that music, and then I have to turn everything off and write.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I feel like I have to make playlists too for all, all of my projects. But sometimes I'll just sit there and make a playlist for like 30 minutes
Oh yeah.
instead of writing.
Oh yeah. There's so many time-wasting opportunities out there, and I find all of them.
It's all part of the process.
Yeah, most of the time, but sometimes you're like, I'm going to find out the history of the railroad tie and get on a spiral towards like the mythology of the railroads. And you're like, this has absolutely nothing to do with what I'm writing. I'm writing a space opera. Why is this happening?
Yeah, I know. You just get like fixated on like one little line of dialogue or something, and you're like, "Oh, did this really happen in 1987?" Like when I was writing my time travel novel about she goes back to 1987, I would constantly to have to be like stop and be like, oh, what baseball teams played on this date, and like just get off on something that had nothing to do with what I was writing.
I almost did that with the beginning of Waking the Woods, which is the novel draft that I'm editing right now. And in my first draft, I had like a little tangent about like 1976 baseball. Why? There was no point. It was just there. I mean, it was an Easter egg, but like it was completely pointless.
Yeah, but in your mind, you're always thinking like, oh, someone is gonna notice this
They will find us.
detail.
It'll be great. And you're just, and then like when you're editing it, you're like, yeah, that really isn't useful. So I'm just gonna that 3 hour, Google dive there. It's just gonna have to go into my extra comments document of maybe
That'll be in the
listening.
outtakes.
Yeah.
So is your process different when you're writing a short story as opposed to a full-length novel?
I've actually only written one novel and I'm now editing it. I have tried to write novels in the past, but it was sort of like either I went whole hog and I was like, I need to plot this ad nauseum. And that does not work. You get bored, it's too much, whatever. Or I'd be like, I'm just going to go and just write. And then, of course, it would peter out by like the third chapter or something. So, of my one experience, I've learned that what I need is, again, those guideposts. And what I did for this one is I said, okay, I know the beginning, I have the beginning drafted out, and I know where I want to end it. And I know I have these characters, and I know I have two narrative points of view. And then I went, okay, I want my first draft to be around 70,000 words. And typically I have my chapters be roughly 2,000 words. That's kind of like the sweet spot where my brain's like, this is a chapter. I don't know why. And so I was like, okay, So if I do that, then it'll be, I can't remember exactly how many chapters it is, 32 chapters, let's say. And then I went, okay, this chapter is Ellis's. What happens? Like just the bullet points, just the big, big bucket. Like, you know, they need to figure out that the woods is a, and I cannot pronounce it correctly, so I'm just going to skip that. But like this, the mushroom network kind of internet concept.
Right.
So like I'm building up to that. So I'm like, okay, how do I do that? Or the ghost needs to appear at least a couple of times. So there needs to be a ghost appearance. Go, go, ghost appearance over here. And I'm like, okay. So then I go, okay, the next chapter is Booker's. And, you know, it's building directly off of this chapter. So what does Booker need to do and know? And how can he help move that plot forward while also having his own emotional journey? And so like, I'd have like a couple of bullet points per chapter. And from there I could go, you know, I'm going to write this chapter because I write all of my chapters in one sitting most of the time. And I'm like, okay, we're going to sit down and we're going to do this. And then I spend 6 hours scrolling the internet. and then a few more hours after that, I finally actually write the, you know, the actual chapter. And that's essentially what I did. But I did the big bullet points at the beginning. And then as I wrote it, I went, this needs 2 more chapters because, you know, dual point of view. So we're going to toss in 2 more chapters and rearrange things and so on and so forth until the draft was done. And now I'm in editing hell where I say, oh, I need to edit this. And then I don't. And I repeat that until I have a due date where I actually have to submit something to someone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, us writers are known for our procrastination. So,
yeah, just a bit.
You know, it's like, yeah. We all need deadlines, or at least I do, because, you know.
I love deadlines. Most of the time they get me to finish something, but occasionally they like fly past my head and at least I got something else done, but maybe not that. But most of the time I get something done. So, you know, I consider that a win.
Right. So where do you have that same kind of plotting out process when you're working on a short story, or is it more like the process of like working on a chapter, just like a whole story?
Kind of both. So typically when I want to write a short story, A, there's some sort of call or something. So like, I know I want to write a thing for this. And so I figure out what it is that I want to be talking about. Typically it starts with an emotion and a beginning scene. And then I typically have, you know, I'll think of it as like having only like 3 bullet points. You have the beginning, you have the ending, and then you might have a few bullet points in the middle. Like you're like, I know that this random bit of dialogue description vibe, whatever, is somewhere in this milieu here. And then I make myself sit down and I waste time. And then I write the short story. And then typically somebody tells me, oh, you forgot to do X. And then I rewrite the short story to some degree or another.
Cool. Yeah. I've never really been like great at writing short stories. Like I always just tend to go on and like turn it into something longer. Like I've done some novellas, you know, but probably nothing shorter than like 20,000 words.
So when I write a short story, typically it's going to be about 4,000 words or less. Occasionally I'll go a little bit longer than that. And the way I try to describe it to other people, and of course this is metaphorical, so it may not work for anyone else but me, is when you're talking about a novella or a novel, you're looking at sort of like a metaphorical town or a metaphorical planet. You have a lot of space and you have a lot of characters. When you're talking about a short story, at least the short stories that I tend to like, which are not necessarily the most popular, so fair enough. it's more like you only have the room. You only have one building.
Right.
You only have the block. You're only focusing in on one character and a small part of their journey that occurs at this moment. And what does that mean for them? And that's it. You can't get distracted of that really cool side character that you want to develop. You can't have 3 different things that they're fighting with at the same time, unless they're thematically related. You really have to be like, okay, narrow focus. Can't look at the bigger world building. You have to do just enough, which means pare it down. You want to hit that description of that setting or that character in like one or two lines.
Right. Versus
the great descriptions that you can get with, you know, say half a page.
Right. So if you're writing like a sci-fi or fantasy short story, is it difficult for you not to do a lot of world building?
Not really. I really focus in on character and their emotions. Mm-hmm. So I haven't really had that be too much of a difficulty. I will say that occasionally I have had, like, when it's the very few short stories that I write that are not like based in like modern sci-fi or modern fantasy type vibe. Mm-hmm. I have been told that, like, yeah, oh, you need to explain this a little bit more. Like, you went too fast. You like blew through that red light, metaphorically speaking, and we have no idea how you got that. So, you know, that's when your beta readers, your, you know, alpha readers, whatever you want to call them, there's so many different names now. Those are when your peer readers come in so much help. They're the ones that go, hey, I know this makes sense to your brain, but you lost us.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so hard to, I mean, well, it's really impossible to like see something you've written objectively.
Oh yeah. And you like, unless you want to let that story sit for, you know, a couple of years, maybe you may not be able to look at it objectively and edit it. And frankly, personally, if I'm letting it sit that long, I'm probably going to look at it 3 years from now and go, oh my God, I'm not editing that. That's no. So it's better for me to just, you know, edit it, get it done, and send it out. And I always advise people to, of course, edit to the best of their degree or best of their ability, I should say. But don't look for perfect. None mm-hmm. of us are ever going to be perfect.
Right. Okay. Well, I think every writer or artist that I know has had a really difficult time writing or creating during the pandemic. So have you experienced this? And do you think you'll be more creative when the world gets back to, quote, normal?
I mean, for me, in some way, like, I hate the pandemic. The pandemic is awful, but the pandemic killed my 2 hours a day of a commute going and coming from my workplace. Mm-hmm. And that extra 2 hours, that extra hour of sleep and that extra non-stress of driving through Atlanta traffic, as you well know, that experience actually made it so I could write a novel for the first time ever, which I thought I would never do. Like, I had this goal of going to Finland as a vacation trip, and I was like, this will be when I finish a novel. And then I was like, this was early 2000. I was like, or 2020, let me correct that because I don't know time. I was like, okay, I am never going to write a damn novel. It's just not going to happen. It's not my skill set. I'm going to plan this trip for February 2021. Obviously, that has gotten rescheduled because we were not going anywhere at that time and still not going anywhere now. But mysteriously, that reward for myself of writing that novel, I ended up doing in 2020. And it's solely because I had way too much time on my hands. So I'm actually really, really hoping that the pandemic ends 100%, but that my work or any of my future work gives more flexibility in the office commute aspect, because I feel like I could do so much better because a lot healthier options will be after the pandemic.
Right.
Know? Socializing, great idea. I would like to meet people in person. It sounds fabulous and alien at this point, but you know, it'll just depend because I still need to pay my bills.
Right.
It could very easily be, I have a healthier time because I can meet people in person, but I no longer have this extra time. And because I don't have this extra time, I'm unable to write longer stories, which at the end of the day is probably not going to be any huge loss, but I would prefer to have that option.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, being obviously the pandemic has been, you know, tragic, and none of us like, wanted it to happen, but the process of you know, quarantining has kind of opened up space, you know, for some people. I mean, like, I hadn't played music in like 6 years or something. And then I, you know, I started playing again. Like, I don't know. It gave me more space to like not feel pressured. You know what I mean? Like, when I was playing shows, I was always feeling like this anxiety about getting people to show up, you know. Ooh, yeah. Or asking people to come see my show, like I was this big inconvenience or something. But you know, if I'm just streaming a show, it's like, oh, you can watch if you want to or not. Like, it's cool. Yeah. So it kind of helps me in that way. But yeah, on the other hand, there definitely has been time when it's just been really difficult to focus, especially last year, you know, during the election and just all of that craziness. I mean, it was nuts.
A whole lot of stress. I will just mention, because I want people to continue to think about this as we go forward, is one of the coolest things about the pandemic, you know, again, taking it out of the context of, you know, the horribleness of the pandemic, is how many things have become available to people that wouldn't otherwise have that availability. Right. So like you're saying, hey, you know, I kept having to ask people to come to my concerts or whatever. Well, sometimes people physically can't, either because they're on the other side of the world, otherwise they would, or because of, you know, a disability or otherwise,
right,
that keeps that stuff inaccessible to them. And yet it's so easy to provide some level of accessibility, particularly after the pandemic. And I've already heard stories of people saying like, oh, you know, I contacted a doctor or otherwise, and, you know, I had access to them because they did teledoc options, and now they're no longer offering it. And it's like, hey, the pandemic isn't over.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I know, it's a shock. And then B, like, why take that away?
Right. You know? Right. Yeah. I mean, that seems weird to me.
Oh, yeah. So,
but yeah. Yeah.
Everyone should think about that when they're making choices. Not saying that you particularly, every time you go and do a show, you should think about these things. But if there is an easy way of making things more accessible to people, why not?
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, I don't think I'm ever going to play like an actual show again, but you know, I might play an acoustic set in my living room and live stream it again. Like that was fun when I did that. Yeah. Okay. So you've talked a lot about having ADHD mm-hmm. and a processing disorder. So yeah. How does this affect your writing process? And are there any ways in which your ADHD makes you more creative?
I have no idea. I'll be honest. It's one of those things that I've always had. I was diagnosed with ADHD and auditory processing disorder when I was 6 or 7. It was very early in my elementary school career. And then I was re-diagnosed with ADHD. And then they were like, yeah, it's probably processing disorder, but we're not really sure. We don't have the skills to assess that. So probably that when I was 18 as an adult. It was sort of like, you just can't get away from it, you know, no matter what you do. You know, it's kind of like, you know, some people say, oh, this is my superpower. I'm more creative than, you know, most people or whatever. And to be honest, I don't know. Like, is it the thing that makes me creative? I don't think it necessarily makes me more creative than anyone. Mm-hmm. I do know that it affects how I communicate, how I, you know, the ways I understand when you should talk, when you should not talk, socialization aspects. But the nitty-gritty, I honestly can't answer, because it's essentially the way my brain was wired and it's always been that way.
Right. Yeah, no, I understand that. I mean, you know, I feel like if you have some kind of condition like ADHD or even like depression, anxiety, it forces you to kind of see the world differently. And mm-hmm. I think that can sometimes have an effect on writing or art that you create.
Yeah, I could see that. And like with Waking the Woods, Ellis is like, not me specifically, different personality, but I utilized Ellis to sort of investigate the type of character I probably needed to see as a kid. Mm-hmm. Which is a non-binary kid with ADHD. Now, as a teenager, I would have hated Ellis. I would not have wanted to read that story at all. So it's more along the lines of, I would have needed it, but I would have hated it. So I wanted to do that. And whether or not I did it successfully, you know, hopefully future readers, if I get an agent and thus and so down the path, et cetera, will be able to determine if I'm successful or not.
Right, right. No, I think that's really cool. And I think obviously we need more representation. You know, and I think one of the cool things about indie publishing is that people, I know authors who, you know, felt like they weren't getting anywhere because like their protagonist was like a person of color or something like that. And then they just said, you know, well, screw this. I'm going to just publish it myself. And it, you know.
Oh yeah. I'm not opposed to that at all. Essentially, I've given myself a personal goal of, I will at least pursue the traditional route of publishing for about a year. And then honestly, for me, I just don't like things hanging out on my hard drive. It just really bugs me. And so at that point, then I'll have to do some more exploring on how to do indie or small pub publishing. There's a couple of different options there. But for, you know, at least I will try, because I have this one policy. It's my biggest policy, is that I can't urge other people to do things that I would not do. Mm-hmm. And that means, yes, I'm going to submit to that mentorship program. Yes, I'm going to submit to these anthologies that I think are way out of my league. Yeah, I'm going to submit to this great pro-level magazine. I may or may not get there. But if I were unable or unwilling to try, then how could somebody else sort of feel like my urging of them to do it, like, where's the validity in that? And that's just a personal thing for me. I want to be able to say, I tried it. And even if I did or did not succeed, there is value in trying, and that, and my urging of them to do so is supposed to be something positive.
Right. Right. Yeah. I totally get that. 'Cause I mean, when I was trying to publish We Own the Sky, at the time it was called The Muses, and I had an agent, and I mean, I had it, like, we had it on submission with publishers for like 2 years or something. Oh, crazy. Wow. And then like, I think it had been like 5 years of just like nothing happening. And mm-hmm. So I was like, well, you know, I'm just gonna get it out there. Like, I feel like at that point it's like, it just needs to be out there. And
I totally
like the, you know, traditional publishing versus indie publishing. Like, it's not like one is better than the other. It's
not at all.
It's a different path for everybody.
Yeah. I don't know as much about indie publishing, but like, you know, because I write mostly LGBT characters, you know, it's sort of like, I've been around a lot of people who publish through smaller publishers, which there are pitfalls in, of course, but a lot of people have found a lot of support and validity in that. And then of course, indie is always an option too. Like, all these different options, why go with one size fits all when you are living in a world where you have so many different choices?
Right. Yeah. I think it's exciting that there are so many like stories available to us at any given time. I think that's really cool.
Oh, same. And you know, it helps me because if I decide that I want to read something very specific, you know, I can pretty much find, if not exactly what I want, then something similar. And that's amazing.
Yeah. I know. You're like, oh, I just really want to read about this space opera with a dragon, you know, I mean, like, you can get really specific.
Exactly.
Cool. So you have been a researcher, a teacher, and a techie. So did these jobs help you with your writing or inspire you in any way?
I would say yes. Nothing like, I can't be like, ah, yes, that time I taught in South Korea is displayed in this story, because that hasn't happened yet. But I sort of view particularly that time of my life, which was like my 20s, where like I bounced around a lot more than I currently do. It was sort of like this building of information. So I might not have written very much during that time, but each thing I did gave me more information, gave me more experience. So, you know, teaching abroad in South Korea, you know, it gave me a whole host of things that I hope I will eventually use. I did use my PhD program in Death of a Time Traveler, which I mentioned before, that's going to be coming out in Writers of the Future. And then the techie part, I mean, any of my sci-fi ties into that.
Right.
I haven't really published a whole lot of my sci-fi, but every piece of it has something to do with something that I either learned during my PhD program, which I escaped before I finished, or my current work, or past experiences, past work that I did, just because it's sort of like it all kind of melds together, like the different questions I want to ask or how I might ask questions.
Right, right. That makes sense. So you know, I think many writers, artists, musicians, et cetera, tend to come back to some of the same themes over and over again. And I know you write a lot of fantasy and sci-fi, mm-hmm. and you write a lot of LGBT plus characters, but I wanted to ask you about the themes that you tend to write about. Like, are there any that you constantly like return to or like to explore in different ways?
So I'm not particularly observant about that, but one of my friends, way back, like almost 10 years ago now, I can't remember exactly why or when she said it, but she virtually looked at me because it was online, and said, you know, Sarah, you always write about voice and choice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably still true today. So what I mean by voice and choice is sort of like, when do you speak and how do you speak and how do your choices on that change? So,
right.
You know, Ellis in my novel is an extremely outspoken character. And so like, how do they decide to you know, sort of quiet that down and why? Or, you know, Booker, the other character, is less outspoken. When do they sort of reach that breaking point where they have to say something? And what choices do they make and why? And so it's all kind of mixed up in that. And I would say that is something that is probably in every story that I write, even if I can't cognitively go, oh, well, it's obviously this or that or the other.
Yeah.
It's probably in there somewhere.
Cool. So, and then you were saying that one was dual point of view. So did that help you to kind of like explore that theme of, you know, using your voice like any differently? Because I've never tried to write in dual point of view. Like, so how was that experience?
Dual point of view is torturous. I have deep regrets. I essentially, like, I needed a dual point of view because I needed a counterbalance to Ellis. And actually in my rewrite right now, I'm essentially trying to build up Booker a little bit more because Booker is a perfectly fine character, but next to Ellis, he kind of pales in comparison because he's just not as dramatic, let's say. And so it's sort of like I'm having to sort of go back through his chapters and kind of boost him up and kind of throw in some more, like, you know, internal conflict and things like that. But he's just a little bit more tightly wound. So the answer is probably, but I don't know how.
That's cool. That's cool. Do you ever get like confused, like who am I writing as? Like, I feel like that would happen to me a lot.
Not really. And I think it's because like the characters are so different. So, you know, Ellis is, you know, has ADHD, they're non-binary, they struggle socially because, you know, they're very much the type of person like I was at the age where, you know, they're going to talk about what they want to talk about right now, right now. It's going to be there and it's going to, you know, be in the middle of class when they shouldn't be doing it. And Booker is a little bit more, you know, reserved. He's not quite reserved, but he's a little reserved. And again, I cannot pronounce words correctly, but he also experiences synesthesia, which I'm, again, terrible pronunciation, but essentially sees voices as colors.
Right.
And so the writing of both characters is very different in that way. You know, I have to be mindful of how is Booker processing the information around him? And that is completely different than how Ellis processes information around them.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense. That's cool. Yeah, that sounds like something I would be interested to read. So hurry up and get an agent.
Here's hoping that my brain will start letting me edit instead of being like, I'm going to look at floor lamps for 6 hours. Thanks, brain. I needed that.
Well, that it's sometimes you need to look at floor lamps. Like
I
sometimes that's part
guess.
of the process, you know.
I didn't buy one, but hey, I now know a lot about them in case you need one.
So, you recently tweeted something that I thought was really cool. You said, if you do art, always try to submit to any opportunity available. No thanks gets easier to hear, and no matter what, you tried and made steps towards something, and that's amazing. So, there's no way to avoid, rejection when it comes to writing or putting your art out there at all. And this, I think, just a great way to look at it. So how did you develop this kind of outlook on rejection, or have you always kind of felt that way about rejection?
Oh, it's because I've gotten lots of rejection. What I would say, and like that tweet makes it sound so easy. What I would say is that there will be things that you're like, oh, that's my dream agent. I don't have one of those, but I've had lots of friends that are like, oh my goodness, this is my dream agent. I'm submitting to them, or my dream publication, which I've had, with anthologies and things. And those are the ones that will, no matter what, kick you in the teeth. They're the ones that you're like, oh, but that would be the most amazing. That would be the best. Oh my goodness, what if? And your emotions get up, and even if you get rejected, which statistically you may, those will be the hardest. And those will not get easier. I mean, they get easier, but not that much easier. You're still going to have like a moping day or whatever. Grab your best friends that deal with your mopey butt during that time and just whine at them. I do it. Everyone does it, as far as I can tell. But the more you submit does sort of like lessen that. And also, I can't remember where I found it. It was on, like, this was 5, 6 years ago. There was a blog post that was going around that said, get yourself a rejection goal. And essentially, if you have a rejection goal, you're going to make sure to send out 10 times more than you would. And most of the time, although not always, you will end up with more acceptances than what you expected. And also, it kind of takes some of the sting out as well, because you have this goal, so you can kind of celebrate. Guess what? I got 20 rejections. And that sounds really weird, unless you're also celebrating with other people who are celebrating those rejections. And again, like, if you do that, you're more likely to get some acceptances along the way as well. And those acceptances wouldn't have happened if you weren't like, I'm going to make sure to at least submit 20 times. A lot of people have a rejection goal of 100. I don't submit that much. I don't write that fast. So I admire people who do that. So, whatever goal works for you. And then if you do get one that you're like, oh, but that was my dream, that was my favorite, I thought that was going to be the perfect one. It doesn't, like, you have people to lean back on and to, express those feelings with.
So what are you working on right now?
So, as I said, I'm editing Waking the Woods, which I'm about 15,000 words in out of about 70. So that's going to take a while. And then I'm plotting out a second novel, which is the working title is Not the Lindbergh Baby, which is essentially a post-magical school war road trip story set in the 70s.
That
And
sounds awesome.
because I hate myself, it has 3 points of view. And it's essentially all about like the different ways the past intrudes on the present. And that's, in some cases, in the case of one character, it's the concept of adoption and finding out they're adopted and what does that mean to them. For another character, it's a kind of they she had a frenemy, and that frenemy died, before the story starts. And so processing that and their feelings towards that. And then another character is trying to completely ignore all of that and keep everything going, and how all of those sort of emotions, especially as teenagers, inevitably implode.
Right. That's cool. That sounds really interesting.
We'll see if it works. I have no idea. It's 3 points of view because, you know, again, masochistic. So,
yeah, but you know, if you do it well, I think it's like those kind of stories can really like be powerful, you know?
I think I'm going to enjoy it if nothing else. And I will probably enjoy it more than going, oh, I guess I'm going to be rewriting this chapter tonight.
Yeah. So are you like one of those people that can edit something and draft something else at the same time?
Somewhat. I'm essentially trying not to draft right now because it's sort of like, I don't want to get sucked down this other story when the first one isn't done enough to like do anything with.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm fighting my urge at the moment, but like at the same time, you have to give your brain little treats, I guess, because you did the good thing. You're going to get a little treat now. This is essentially what's going on. So occasionally I'll be like, okay, I already have like my basic outline going on here. So, okay, we're going to talk about the next chapter. What does that mean? And how does that go?
Right.
That sort of thing.
That's cool.
You can draft as a treat.
Yeah. I like that. It's kind of like bribing yourself to like send it. You
should always bribe yourself in writing and anything creative, because as much as you love doing it, there's part of you that gets distracted by floor lamps.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. So what books or TV shows or movies, music are you really into right now?
I mean, honestly, right now I'm kind of in a dry spell. I think it's because we relatively recently went through our whole, you know, quarantine anniversary, and my brain was just like, I hate everything. And I desperately need a break from work. So I'm giving myself that. I'd say aside from that, like, it's kind of like I've been going with like old favorites. So mm-hmm. like what I recently rewatched was like Sense8. And then.
I love that show.
Oh yeah. It's nice. Like, I mean, yes, there's drama and stuff like that, but like, I like the found family trope a lot. And right. So that gives me a lot of comfort, particularly since I'm a single person during the pandemic. So I've like been in like face-to-face interaction with like three people in a year. And then like, I've been listening to Hadestown and just kind of like whatever turns up. There's nothing mm-hmm. I can't be like, oh, I've been, you know, binging this. It's just been like, you know, whatever. That looks good. I'll watch that. I do love watching Nailed It though, because I'm like, if I were on a cooking show, that is the one I could do. I probably wouldn't win, but I could at least be like, yes, this is, I'm on par with this. Where all the other cooking shows, I'm like, I'd like to pretend that I could do that, but no, absolutely not.
That's funny. So I have kind of a big question that I ask everyone. So why do you think art is important?
For me, and like, again, this is just, you know, my personal bias, is it's all about communication and creating connectivity with people. Mm-hmm. The fastest way to connect with somebody else is to share a story. And I think we use that in very, you know, innocuous, simple ways every day. And then of course, when we want to wind down, what do? We watch a TV show, which is a story, or we listen or read to a book, which is a story, or we call up a friend and we say, oh my God, you won't believe what happened today. And then you tell a story.
Yeah. I think storytelling is just, you know, like ingrained within us. Like, I think it's how we kind of make sense of the mm-hmm. world, I think.
Oh, yes. It's definitely part of sense making. And then also finding that way of, you know, not just sense making with yourself, but sense making with other people and finding that commonality, you know, those feelings or experiences. Well, some of the experiences, I just had a moment of flashback to Greek mythology, and there are several experiences I hope we are not experiencing, but you get the idea at least.
Yeah, totally. So where can people find you and your work?
So most of my work is on my website, which is, let me I forgot what my website is, so I'm looking
it up. Yeah, I can link to it on findcreativeexpression.com. So
it's mxsfox.com. So mixfox. Since I'm non-binary, I have the MX. And then, yeah, that should have all the links to everything. So that'll probably be the easiest way of finding anything. And then, of course, I'm on Twitter and otherwise, and I like talking to people. So anyone's welcome to talk to me anytime.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, yeah, thanks. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. That was great. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
I had such a great time chatting with Sarah, and I hope you all found it helpful as well. Coming up on the next episode, I am talking to musician Kim Ware. Kim is like one of the coolest, you know, Atlanta musicians that I know. So I'm super excited to talk to her. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you in the next episode. Thanks for listening to the Find Creative Expression podcast. Please take a moment to leave us a review on your favorite podcasting platform. You can find me on Instagram at Sarah E. Crawford or youtube.com/Sarah Crawford. Also find me on Patreon at patreon.com/Sarah Crawford to support the podcast for just $1 a month. And that's Sarah, S-A-R-A, without an H. I hope you've been inspired today, and I'll see you in 2 weeks for the next podcast.